supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Marked by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Back in the 90s, in the early days of the internet, a study on gambling impact said that high-speed instant gratification of internet games and the high level of privacy they offer may exacerbate problem and pathological gambling. Well, almost 10 years later, the number of people gambling online increases by the thousands, and they can do it at home, they can do it in their pajamas and slippers, as we will hear. And for some, it's an innocent pastime, but for some, it can turn into an addiction. On today's show, we'll discuss who's at risk and why, what kinds of treatments are available. We'll also hear from Martha Frankel. She's a successful writer who lost nearly everything playing poker online. My guests today, joining me on the phone, are Dr. Nancy Petrie. She's a professor of psychiatry and director of the Gambling Treatment Center at the University of Connecticut Health Center. Nancy, welcome to Voices.
Thank you.
And I'm also joined here in the studio by Rick Cerlino. He is a therapist in private practice with the Starting Point in South Jersey and a licensed addictions counselor. Rick, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan.
Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. If you gamble online, think you have a problem or might have a problem, give us a call. Or if you have a loved one that you're concerned about. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Nancy, let's start with you. Is there any way to estimate the numbers of people who gamble online versus those who gamble at casinos?
I don't know if we have those exact estimates. I've been doing some research looking at internet gambling as well as other forms of gambling, and what we find is that in terms of adults, the adult population, it's still a relatively small proportion of the adult population that ever gamble on the internet. In two different studies spanning nearly 2,000 people, we found only about 7% have ever gambled on the internet. But what is quite interesting is of those 7% of adults who've gambled on the internet, over 60% of them have a problem with gambling.
Wow. And what about at the casinos? What percent of those have a problem?
Those estimates is not as high as 60%. I think it's around the probably around 10% or so of people who are gambling at casinos would have a problem with gambling.
Wow. So why?
Why? Well, I think it's the technology of internet gambling and the wide availability of it. It's bringing gambling into people's homes. And the population where actually I think the greatest cause for concern is in college students. We've recently published a study in over 1,300 college students, and we found that 23% of them have reported gambling on the internet, so much higher than the rates we see in adults. And I think that's because more adolescents or college students are accustomed to being on the internet and finding things on the internet and so forth. So rates of gambling participation are much higher with respect to internet gambling.
Wow. You know, those numbers, I mean, they take your breath away. When you say 23% of college students gamble online, that's one thing. But when we think that 60% of those kids are at risk of...
not at risk, have developed. I was just getting to that number. The college student percentage of the 23 who've gambled on the internet, 23%, 61.6% of them have pathological gambling.
Rick, let me turn to you. Why are kids at such high risk?
Well, I think, first of all, in our largesse as a growing economy, we've educated our children at a very young age to use technology. And henceforth, there's a certain amount of our young people going up into college age that are becoming compulsive gamblers in training simply by learning the use of computer technology. And it's very seductive to them. Most of the new slots and gambling avenues in the casinos themselves are almost a video game. And people getting interested in video games at a young age and then moving on is just a natural progression. In fact, some of the online gambling is seductive that way. They present themselves as a game to the young person on the internet and eventually make them an offer to begin to gamble.
I'm curious about how the larger world is looking at this business of online gambling. And I'll turn back to you, Nancy. I spoke with a young man who was considering playing poker online for a living. He made a pretty clear and dispassionate choice that that's what he was going to do. He was going to do some research and do it. But I also received an email from a woman who wanted to know if there was a psychologist I could recommend for her son who was considering doing this for a living, and not to talk him out of it, but to help him do it better, to cut down on his risks of addiction and help him make clear choices. And that really speaks to the psychology of online poker today. There really has been a fundamental shift in our society's way of thinking about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. It's becoming common facet of life that gambling is spreading all around us, and the access to it on the internet is making it particularly tempting, especially with youth and college-age students who are really well-attuned at getting around on the internet.
There's another factor I wonder about, and I'll turn to you, Rick. From a psychological perspective, with online gambling, you have to spend your money first. You've got to put money up front on your credit card as opposed to playing hand by hand at a casino. What does that do psychologically? What does that change?
Well, it keeps the person in action a lot longer. It keeps them isolated and gambling even surreptitiously at night or alone most of the time. I think the doctor's point with young people is interesting. We even now have family places to go in Las Vegas for people to bring their whole family and they can go gamble. And I don't think 20 years ago we'd have had anything like that in Las Vegas or any place else. Mm. So it takes a look at the way we as a society approach the whole issue of lotteries and gambling in general and how we're just eroding what our thoughts were about it to the point that it's perfectly acceptable to go down this road.
We're talking about online gambling, specifically online gambling addiction, with Dr. Nancy Petry, who's a professor of psychiatry. She directs the Gambling Treatment Research Center at University of Connecticut Health Center. I'm also here with Rick Cerlino. He's a therapist with the Starting Point in South Jersey. Do you think that the primary issue here, and I'll turn to you, Rick, is access? That is that the pivotal issue between casino gambling and the risk for online addiction?
I think the doorway to any addiction is the high. And online addiction, people gambling, pathological gamblers, the same brain chemistry takes place in a pathological gambler that takes place in the brain of someone smoking crack. So when you begin to see that a process can cause that kind of a brain change and a high, that's the first doorway that we encounter, the high that the person is getting, the mania from it.
Nancy, do you see it that way?
Well, actually, I don't necessarily believe that all gamblers get a high, as Rick was describing. In fact, we see a large number of pathological gamblers who aren't really reporting a high in the sense that you see with drugs and drug addiction, but are gambling more as an escape mechanism. And they almost seem to be two discrete reasons for gambling. Some people certainly are going for the high, as Rick was just describing. But I think another cohort, and this is particularly true with the older adult women pathological gamblers, they seem to be gambling more to escape negative moods as a way to sort of not think about their other problems in their life and so forth. And I think internet gambling can hit both types. Both the action-oriented gamblers, they're there for the high and the excitement of it, as well as the escape gamblers, the people who are gambling to, in order to escape their problems and for depression reasons and so forth.
Well, even the younger people, there was a study published by a psychologist here in Philadelphia years ago where he studied suburban kids in affluent neighborhoods. And he found that because of the stresses they experienced in their lives, that explained a lot of weekend drinking, getting high, having sex, because their lives were so jammed with activities and pressure to achieve and perform that this was their only respite. And so I wonder if some of these college kids who are gambling online are really looking for respite from the stress in their lives. Rick?
Well, I certainly think there's a numbing to it. I certainly think there's an escape to it, as the doctor mentioned. And there is the other part that is the high to some people. It's interesting. Here again, it's like any other process or compulsive problem. It depends on the person and the individualized symptoms that they manifest. But a lot of times what we're seeing are people who really begin to become very introverted, begin to surreptitiously gamble. There's timelessness to it. They're undetected and uninterrupted for long periods of time.
Which is very much unlike a casino.
Exactly.
So you can really hide and don't have to deal with the shame. I wonder, and I'll turn to you, Nancy, who's at more risk for online gambling addiction?
I think definitely younger adults and, well, clearly people with access to the internet in their home. The other thing is a lot of people who had gambling problems with other forms of gambling, so casino gamblers or people who are playing cards elsewhere, they're the ones who tend to gravitate toward the online gambling. So people with a prior history of extensive gambling are more likely to move toward the internet gambling, and then, as we've noted, they have very high rates of either developing pathological gambling or perpetuating their pathological gambling.
All right, we've been throwing words around, and I want to ask you both to address them. Pathological gambling, gambling addiction, problem gambling. So let me turn to you, Nancy. How does one know when one's in trouble, or how do you assess when one's...
Well, pathological gambling is the official name of a psychiatric disorder by the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It's the American Psychiatric Association's guideline of diagnosing psychiatric illnesses. So pathological gambling is the official title of the disorder, and there's 10 specific criteria. An individual would need to endorse at least 5 of those 10 criteria to receive a diagnosis. Pathological gambling is the extreme form of the disorder where people are gambling with more money than they can afford to. They're gambling in increasing amounts. They're spending more time gambling than they intend and so forth. They're lying to others about trying to cover up how much they're gambling. Typically, what we refer to as problem gambling encompasses both pathological gambling as well as a sub-diagnostic threshold condition. And so that affects a much larger proportion of the population, the sub-threshold condition. People who are endorsing perhaps some of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual criteria, but not the full 5 necessary for a diagnosis.
And Rick, is it like other addictions in that you need more and more over time?
Well, I think the pure nature of gambling, if you're chasing, what they call chasing in the illness, you're going to need more money to chase your losses. And there are times with people that do get high from it they do need more money and more action and longer terms of action. And that's where even healthcare problems can come in.
And that would be for the group of people. We're talking about two different groups of people. That would, what you're describing sounds like the group of people who are looking for it for the high, for brain stimulation. And I wonder if that would be the same, and I'll turn back to you, Nancy, for the group of people who are looking for respite from stress or depression. Do they need more and more?
Yes, they need. It's similar, I think, in both groups. It's one of the hallmark symptoms of pathological gambling, and actually one of the early symptoms is gambling with more money and over greater time periods than initially intended.
We're going to have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to introduce you guys and our listeners to Martha Frankel, who slipped into online gambling addiction and it almost ruined her life. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about online gambling addiction. Our number is 888-477-9499. If you gambled online and sometimes wonder if you are slipping into it or developing a problem, give us a call. Or if you have a loved one that you're concerned about, again, that's 888-477-9499. My guests are Rick Cerlino. He's a therapist in private practice. He's with the Starting Point in South Jersey. Dr. Nancy Petrie is a professor of psychiatry and director of the Gambling Treatment Research Center at the University of Connecticut Health Center. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
As the Philadelphia City Council talks about how to spend the $4 billion in taxes paid by everyone who lives, works, or plays in the city, we want you to have your say. WHYY, in partnership with the Daily News, presents It's Our Money, reports on the city budget not only in a way that you can understand, but also in a way in which you can participate. To give your testimony about the city's priorities for the coming year, visit our website at whyy.org and click on It's Our Money.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about online gambling addiction today. And before we get back to our guest experts, I want to introduce you to Martha Frankel. In her childhood home, there was always a game going on. Her mother played cards or mahjong. Her father ran a friendly poker game for money. And the kids, well, they played cards too. As an adult, Martha continued to enjoy gambling. A successful writer, she enjoyed playing cards with her friends and eventually learned a lot about playing poker for money from her cousin, who was a professional player. She practiced the game at home. She did pretty well at the casinos, winning lots of money and enjoying her time at the tables. But things changed dramatically when she started to play poker online. She spoke with our producer, Mike and Scott, about her new memoir, Hats and Eyeglasses.
When and how did you discover online poker?
One night I went to Atlantic City, and the poker room was a lot emptier than it had been. And I asked one of the dealers what was going on, and he said, why come here to play when you could play at home in your pajamas? And I said, what does that mean? Because that had been my dream. And he said, oh, you can play poker online. And I thought, oh, my God, because I live 4 hours from Atlantic City, from the nearest casino, and I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to go home and do that, and I'm going to do that for a few hours every day, and it'll be like a great income. Because in live games, I had been winning a lot of money. And so I went home and found, it was hard then to find the poker sites, although now there are hundreds of thousands. There were not then. And I finally found one and downloaded it, and they give you, like, pretend money. And so you can play pretend games. And I did really good at those pretend games. And I started to think, oh, my God, I'm never going to have to work again. I'm just going to stay home in my pajamas and play poker.
And when did you switch to real money?
After a few weeks, I said, okay, I'm ready, and I put put my credit card, type my credit card number into it, and charge $300, which was the most you could charge. And I typed in my credit card. I went to a table, like a virtual table. My name was there. And I lost that money in about an hour and a half. And that had never happened to me at the poker table. I mean, I've lost, for sure, but not like that. And not so anonymously and not without, you know, some level of amusement. And I was shocked.
What was different about you had done well in the pretend game? What was different now?
I don't know. I didn't know. So the next day I went back and charged $300 again. And I lost that in an hour. And I said, okay, well, here's two things that are different. One is I don't know who I'm playing against at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could be here at my office and those other five players could be in one room together. I don't know that. And part of my winning at poker has to do with who I am as a person, what my personality is like. And none of that matters online. So there I was, $600, 2 days, $600 in the red. And instead of saying, okay, this was an experiment that didn't go well, I charged $300 more the next day. I was almost like a change in my brain chemistry.
And what happened the third day?
I lost too. And it went on and on and on. Every day I said, I have to stop this. And every day I did it.
Did you see gradual success? Was there, or
no.
Was...
No, that's really the... I never did well at it. I mean, I lost tens of thousands of dollars. And when I play poker, if I lose, you know, if I walk in with $300 in my pocket or $500 and I lose it, I would never go to the ATM machine. I would never reach into my pocket for more. But the online stuff, I was like banging up against a wall all the time and I couldn't stop it.
How long was this going on for?
And on about a year and a half.
And during that year, talk about how this impacted your life, your work, your relationship.
Well, I told no one. No one, not my husband, not my family, not my friends. And I started withdrawing in every way. Part of it was that my town didn't have cable. We had dial-up for the computers then. And so every time you called me, I got bounced off the computer. So I got furious when people called me. So I started, like, telling everybody to stop bothering me at work. And like anybody who's hiding their addiction, I withdrew from my family. I started turning down assignments because I had to make back that money. And I didn't, instead of saying, okay, go away for a week, do a story, make $5,000, I started saying I wanted to get the money back from that poker site, from those people. And I couldn't see that I was just falling down this rabbit hole of debt and despair.
What happened to you financially? How were you able to hide?
I made a lot of money. I was making a lot of money still. So I was, you know, paying off my credit cards. But then I stopped taking assignments. So my credit card debts, you know, just mounted. And, of course, as soon as they mounted, I kept getting offers for more and more credit cards. So I just ran up tremendous bills and could not see a way out of it.
And your husband didn't catch on, or did he suspect?
No, my husband is an artist who has a very... He's uncomfortable with money in the best of times. And I do... And I'm the one with the good head for numbers. I'm the one who takes care of all of our bills. And so... You know, he knew that things weren't great, that I wasn't bringing in a lot of money, and he, you know, his business was doing okay, and it was, no, he didn't catch on. All addicts are really brilliant in hiding the thing that they're addicted to.
How did you feel during that time? Was there a sense
of horrible,
dread?
Horrible, horrible. I woke up every day and just felt like today would be the day I would just kill myself. That this was too much to bear, and that I was so ashamed and so horrified that I had done this to myself, and that nobody, how could anybody ever look at me again if they knew the truth?
So when did it all come to a head? When did you decide this is
really
the
day? I didn't know that, I mean, I really didn't see what was ever going to stop me. And then one day my mother, who was by then really blind and really old, called me hysterical crying and said, what have I done to you? What have I done to make you so angry? And it was the shame of that really got me to just walk away from my computer for a day, and then 2 days, and then three. It wasn't like I said, okay, that's it, I'm done. It was more gradual. It was the just not doing it. And then I realized that I hadn't done it in a month. And then there was more time. And then one day I crossed over that line and realized I was done with it.
When did you start telling people that this was what had been going on?
Okay, here's the good part here. I sold I wrote the proposal for this book about a year and a half ago, maybe a little bit longer. And I showed it to my agent, and she sold it, so my editor knew. And then I wrote the book, and then I sent it to my family and my husband. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. I couldn't say the words. I was so sure that everyone was going to turn away from me.
And what was their reaction?
Just the opposite of what I thought. I mean, Steve was angry with me, but more concerned that this had happened to me. And everyone has been so, just really enveloped me and said, I wish you had told me. I wish I could have helped you. But of course, that's the thing, is that nobody can help an addict until they want to be helped.
When you walked away from the computer, especially in the beginning, did you have symptoms of withdrawal?
I don't know that much about coming off drugs or alcohol, or I haven't had those experiences, thank God. But this was the same thing. I would yearn for it. I would sit at home and think, I can't go into my office because that's where that thing had happened to me. And so the first thing I did was stay away from my office for almost a month. And then I went in and I moved my desk, because I felt like if I ever sat in the desk in the position it had been in, I would go back to it. So I moved the desk and I painted. But at night I would get into bed and I would close my eyes and I would see that the visual of that poker table online, and I would literally yearn to be back there.
So you did this completely alone without any help?
Well, I went to a Gamblers Anonymous meeting, but it was just, it didn't strike a chord in me.
How do you feel about it now? Do you feel secure?
I'm so over it. I'm fine. I'm doing great. Writing this book was, you know, sitting at the computer for 8 months writing this book was so cathartic and great, and now I'm working on two other things that I'm really excited about, and I still play poker in my weekly game, and, you know, it's very social and fun, and my poker buddies have been the most supportive people about this, you know. But the online thing, now I'm totally over it.
Martha Frankel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Martha Frankel is the author of Hats and Eyeglasses. She spoke with our producer, Mike and Scott, and we are talking about online gambling addiction. Who is at risk? What it means? What stopping it means? My guests are Dr. Nancy Petry. She's a professor of psychiatry, director of the Gambling Treatment Research Center at the University of Connecticut Health Center. I'm also joined by Rick Cherlino. He is a therapist in private practice at The Starting Point in New Jersey and a licensed addictions counselor. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, Nancy and Rick, there's certainly a lot to talk about. Let me start with you, Nancy. Martha said that it felt like her brain chemistry changed. What was actually happening in her brain?
I don't think we still have a very good understanding of the physiology of gambling. There's been a lot of speculations about that perhaps gambling does influence different neurochemicals, or that people with abnormalities, for example, particularly low dopamine levels, may respond differently to gambling and find it more rewarding or reinforcing or enticing than other people. There certainly is some genetic component to pathological gambling. It can run in families, but it certainly isn't a 100% genetically transmitted disorder. The genetic component of it is just a really small proportion of it. But people are starting to look at how brain mechanisms may change in response to gambling.
I'm curious about one thing she said, and I know she's not here and can't address it. Rick, maybe you could offer a guess here. She invested $300 and then another $300, and at that moment, she decided not to walk away, that this was a failed experiment, and to try again. What was happening with her at that moment? Because, you know, usually positive reinforcement keeps you in it. You get a couple of hits, you know, a couple of wins. She apparently didn't get any. There was nothing there.
Well, there's two parts to that. First of all, I think there's the seduction of pathological gambling. The second part is the ego. The ego of a pathological gambler, which is, like she said, there's somebody out there, and I'm going to get that money back from them. And she was hooked into the game.
It was anger.
Yeah. And we see that a lot, especially in the rising tide of the most compulsive gamblers we're seeing now. It's rising mostly in college-age students, but a lot amongst women. Women are at great risk as we go along to see that they're more involved in gambling.
Why?
At this point.
Why?
Well, I think the good doctor could probably speak better to that, but what I could say is there are different reasons why men and women gamble. And generally, you know, and I think women have different reasons for gambling that have to do with freedom and power and empowerment and independence, as opposed to men who gamble for other reasons.
Nancy, you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, I completely agree with Rick on that one. We do see, and this is something I talked about earlier, that women do tend to gamble for different reasons. Often we see the disorder of pathological or problem gambling developing in women later in life, whereas with men it often occurs earlier in life. And I think it has to do with some of the things Rick was talking about, that women are doing it for independence or for to have some control over what they're doing and how they're spending their money. A really common theme we hear about among the women pathological gamblers is that this is the first time they've been able to spend money on themselves and doing something that they enjoy themselves. Many of these women start gambling after their children leave home and or after a marriage has turned bad or they've left a marriage, and gambling is filling a void in their lives, and now they're finally feeling like, my children have left home, I'm now perhaps financially independent. I'm not always spending all my time taking care of others. This is something I'm doing for myself, something that I enjoy doing, and that's how it starts off. But unfortunately, as we heard, it can lead into a much greater problem.
Well, there's another factor at play here, too. I don't know if you're aware of this, Nancy. I'm a quadriplegic, and about 5-6 years after my accident, you know, I developed a clinical depression, and I found myself going down to Atlantic City to the casinos. I mean, a place where I grew up. I was comfortable there, and I was going there more and more. I didn't develop a problem, but I loved it because it eliminated, you know, all of my depressive ruminations, and B, it was something I could do independently from my wheelchair. I didn't have to pick up cards or so on and so forth. And I went down there more and more, and I found that as my depression lifted, I just stopped going down there. I don't hardly gamble at all anymore. And I look at the faces of people at the casino, and most of them look depressed to me or numb. So what's the relationship between depression and gambling addiction?
There certainly is a strong relationship between depression and pathological gambling. We found in a lot of epidemiological research that people with a lifetime history of depression have a 3.3-fold increased risk of developing pathological gambling. And I did not know about your disability, and I'm sorry to hear that. Also, we've been looking into the association between disability and pathological gambling, and we found very high rates of problem and pathological gambling in people with disabilities, and I think exactly for the reasons you were describing, it is still something that you can do. It's a way of you know, going somewhere and being around people.
Yes.
It can help with loneliness. It can help with depression. And I'm glad you were able to get away. And as your depression lifted, you moved away from the gambling rather than the gambling, which usually leads to greater depression.
Yeah, I fortunately, for a lot of reasons, I'm not at risk for gambling addiction. I think my baseline guilt level is way too high. And speaking of emotions, as my clinician's ear heard the word shame when Martha talked about her addiction, and I'll turn to you, Rick. Because of her shame, she wanted to end her life. And you hear that a lot, especially with addictions, that they want to commit suicide because they can't tolerate the shame. And here, in her, as her story unfolds, her mother made her feel even more ashamed, and that helped her begin to end the addiction. How do you understand that?
Well, there are a few things at play. First of all, I'd like to say that our typical idea of what a compulsive gambler is or a pathological gambler is a middle-aged male. And here we're talking about women. We heard from a woman. So the first thing is people don't expect young people or women to have problems with gambling. So we have that stereotype. Then we have the whole issue of women securing treatment and the issue of being a gambling mother or a gambling wife or just a gambling woman or somebody that is not living up to their responsibilities. There's a lot of shame that's involved in that. I think shame may be a good motivator at times to get into treatment or to stop, but it won't keep you stopped.
Well, let's take that point. We'll take a short break, and we'll come back and talk about treatment, what options are available, who goes in, what works, and what doesn't, and we'll get to the phones. We're talking about online gambling addiction today. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. My guests are Dr. Nancy Petrie, professor of psychiatry. She's director of the Gambling Treatment Research Center at the University of Connecticut Health Center. I'm joined here in the studio with Rick Cerlino. He's a therapist at the Starting Point in South Jersey and a licensed addictions counselor. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
A regular meeting of the WHYY Community Advisory Board is scheduled for Wednesday, March 12th at noon at WHYY 625 Orange Street, Wilmington. For more information, call Harriet Blanchard at 215-351-1293.
Next time on Day to Day.
This neighborhood is dangerous. You have to fear for your life when you walk out your door.
South Los Angeles is facing a wave of deadly and apparently random gang shootings.
So far, police have few answers.
Gang's always going to be here, but the best thing we can do is just minimize it.
How the community is trying to cope.
What do you wish this neighborhood were like?
Not shooting little kids.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the teachers and school support professionals of the Pennsylvania State Education Association, 185,000 men and women working for great public schools for every child. PSEA, Leadership for Public Education.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about online gambling addiction. My guests are Rick Cerlino, therapist in private practice at the Starting Point in South Jersey, Dr. Nancy Petrie, professor of psychiatry, director of the Gambling Treatment Research Center at the University of Connecticut Health Center. And our number is 888-477-9499. Well, Nancy, let's talk about treatment. Martha certainly didn't follow a conventional plan. She just quit. 12-step programs certainly aren't for everybody. What are some of the alternatives?
Well, actually, the way she quit is the most common way people with gambling problems quit. Something like 85 to 90% of people with pathological gambling never seek treatment for the disorder, and many of them are able to quit on their own. That certainly doesn't mean everyone is able to quit on their own, and many do seek treatment either at GA or through professional therapists. We tend to find, and Rick can probably speak to this himself, that your average therapist out in the community will have very little, if any, experience working with pathological gambling. So So I think it is important that people with the disorder seek treatment with a specialized group or in a specialized program with therapists who are familiar with the disorder, because it is and can be different from other treatment of other psychiatric disorders.
You know, there's a lot of factors here, Rick, that we've been talking about. One is it's an addiction, but can any addictions, somebody who's knowledgeable about addictions, work with online gambling addiction? Do you need to know specifically about gambling addiction and subspecifically about online? Is there a different knowledge base for regular gambling and online gambling?
Well, I think there are different types of gamblers. And I think if you're going to treat gamblers, you're going to have to know the different types of gambling that's going on, everything from sports betting to online gambling and casino gambling. I think if you're dealing with someone that doesn't have any expertise or schooling in the issues of pathological gambling, they're probably going to miss some of the nuances of treating some of the folks that have gambling issues. What I know is that we've spent a lot of time studying in this state, in Pennsylvania, and their Council on Compulsive Gambling with Jim Pappas, and in New Jersey's Council on Compulsive Gambling, a lot of time studying the issues of pathological gambling and making sure that we understood the criteria and what treatment is most effective.
You made an interesting statement during our break, Rick, about women entering treatment versus men.
Yes. Especially in 12-stepping, as I said, the real profile of a pathological gambler in most people's minds is a man, a middle-aged man. And we're asking women now who developed this problem to go into 12-step programming where in the rooms are predominantly men. And it's been my observation that there's been some difficulty retaining women in those support groups for a long time. That is changing now, that more women are coming to the fore and becoming involved in treatment, getting well, and participating in recovery from pathological gambling. But it was a big issue up until about 5 years ago of retaining women in the rooms and in recovery.
I wonder, Nancy, what would you recommend a different treatment for a woman versus a man gambler?
I wouldn't necessarily recommend a different treatment, but what I think Griff is saying is absolutely correct in that the traditional GA room from years ago would be highly unusual to see a woman there, and I think women felt very isolated in GA meetings. That certainly, I think, is changing, and I know here in Connecticut we have GA rooms that are primarily attended by women. There's the women's groups, for example, where they do feel more comfortable. And I don't necessarily recommend one form of treatment over another. Some people certainly like GA, and if they feel comfortable going there, they should certainly do so. Well, whether or not they want additional professional treatment is certainly possible and can be helpful.
When you say additional professional treatment, are you talking about basically one-on-one psychotherapy with an expert, or are you talking about something else, medication?
Primarily, I'm talking about psychotherapy. There is no medication that is approved by the FDA to treat pathological gambling. There's drugs that are being tested experimentally, but they're not approved for treatment of this disorder. And I think that's important to recognize. There's not a magic pill that's going to stop people from gambling. So the most typical form of professional treatment for gambling would involve psychotherapy, whether it's done individually with a therapist or in a group-based setting with a therapist.
I would think the other factor that would make a 12-step program or a group more difficult for a problem gambler is that many gamblers tend to be individuals, tend to isolate, tend to not like to socialize with people, Rick?
Yeah. And I also think that there's an issue, there's a real elephant in the living room on this, is that it isn't covered by health care coverage. And by the time most people seek treatment for pathological gambling, they have no resources to get treatment. There aren't a lot of inpatient facilities for pathological gambling. There are a few. Most of them are state-funded. And individual psychotherapy with a counselor or a therapist is not cheap. And so here again, we're putting more pressure on a family unit that may already be under financial stress because of the gambling.
One of the slogans in most 12-step programs is to stay away from people, places, and things that trigger the addiction. But, you know, online these days is tough to stay away from. You can't stay away from a computer. So how does one navigate those waters? Nancy, any thoughts?
Yeah, that's an interesting question and certainly something that the Internet gamblers have struggled with. I think that the general recommendation is to stay off of the computer, turn it off, turn off your Internet service, which is possible, at least in the home setting, especially to do this in the beginning. It's possible people may be able to go back and use online for other purposes after they've had some experience with abstinence and cessation of gambling, just as the woman who was speaking earlier described. I think what she described is a really good technique, and it helped her immensely. She said something about she completely changed her office around. She made her office no longer remind her of the gambling by doing something really, you know, quite dramatic in terms of how it looked. And that is something people can try. It might not necessarily work for everyone. I think she had a lot of motivation and good reason and a lot of self-resources to stop her gambling. A lot of other people don't describe it being quite as easy as she did to stop.
Rick, what do you advise people when it comes to staying away from the Internet or staying away from the computer if their livelihoods depend on it?
Well, just like the casinos have a way for you to keep yourself out of a casino, to take yourself off the list, there is also a way to block things like pornography or online gambling on the computer if you're willing to take that step. But here again, that's a conscious step to take to put a guard on your computer. The problem is the cost in the workplace when people are doing this in the workplace when they should be working.
Yeah, it's interesting. You can block it on a computer. It reminds me of antabuse with alcoholism. Yeah. You can take a pill then that'll make the so that when you drink the alcohol make you terribly ill. But again, that's a conscious decision.
And you may not be able to block every site. You can certainly block your most commonly used sites.
That's true. Talk about predatory. I mean, we've got predatory gambling sites, and we've got predatory credit cards on top of that. Let's go to the phones. We've got Joanne on the line. Joanne?
Yes.
Hi there.
Good afternoon, Doctor. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, I'm told you might know one of our guests.
I know him a little bit.
Yeah.
Yes, I know Rick.
Well, I'm happy for that. I'm told you know him quite well, actually.
Thank you.
What can we do for you?
Thank you. I have so much to say. I want to try to focus in. First of all, thank you so much for sharing. I did not know you were a quadriplegic either, so I really appreciate you sharing that.
Sure.
And if I could take something that you shared about your guilt, it really struck me, and that's why I really decided to make the phone call. I've been abstinent from gambling 25 years now, and often through the years people have asked me or made comments about gambling. What's it related to? I couldn't gamble. I would just hate to lose money. I'd feel so guilty. I'd be ashamed. I think that a couple things about the guilt and money are, one, people don't gamble necessarily for the money. I think a lot of people who don't gamble think that, but the money is a vehicle to stay into what I call disassociating. With what the other doctor was talking about, Nancy, about women, a lot of women gamble to escape. I totally agree with that. I think a lot of our senior gamblers tend to do that for escape reasons. But to me, the word high could mean whether you're being sedated or feeling like you're on an amphetamine high. It's all disassociating. So the money is strictly to keep you in that state of mind to disassociate. So that's the thing I wanted to say about money. Guilt and shame, you know, a lot of gamblers suffer tremendously with guilt and shame. So that isn't enough of a motivator to get them to stop. The longer you gamble, the more that gambling kind of covers those emotions. You can push the guilt and the shame further and further away. So,
but let me ask you the same question I asked my guests. On this issue, she felt tremendous shame, Martha did, like anybody would. But it was shame that got her to change her mind, to begin to change.
Absolutely, and that was excellent. She had a moment of sanity, we call it. That little bit of opening. Her mother just called, who knows, that right moment of expressing her feelings hit her, and it worked.
Well, maybe the word should be a moment of sanity. Joanne, I want to thank you so much for...
Could I say one more thing about Gamblers Anonymous?
Quickly, we're low on time.
Very quickly. Women, you know what? Some people don't want to go to Gamblers Anonymous because they believe in complete abstinence. Once you're a gambler, if you're a true pathological gambler, you have to stay away from all forms of gambling. That's been my experience. And thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Nancy, we're going to ask you to comment on that, on Joanna's final statement. Do you think gamblers need to stay away from all forms of gambling?
That's the absolute recommendation that we give. We highly recommend that. The unfortunate thing is most pathological gamblers don't stay away from all forms of gambling. And what we see is a lot of people moving in and out, having problems at times, and then doing quite well at times, and backward and forward. And I think that's important, that if they do ever see their gambling increasing, and that might be just with a single bet or a single scratch ticket, you have to consciously think about it, because it can lead back to the problem behavior.
And these days that's getting even more difficult as more and more of our states become more addicted on gambling revenues from lotteries and casinos in the states. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
My guests have been Dr. Nancy Petrie. She's a professor of psychiatry and director of the Gambling Treatment Research Center at the University of Connecticut Health Center. Rick Cherlino is a psychotherapist in New Jersey with Starting Point. I believe that's in Collingswood. And he's a licensed addictions counselor. Well, tune in to TV12 for my TV special, Learning from the Heart, Lessons on Living, Loving, and Listening. It'll be aired throughout the weekend, and you can hear it on Saturday, this coming Saturday, March 15th at 5:30 p.m., and for additional times, visit whyy.org. Also this weekend, I'll be talking about my new book on Saturday the 15th at Barnes & Noble in Moorestown, New Jersey, and Sunday the 16th at Barnes & Noble at Exton, Pennsylvania. For additional information, visit my website at drdangottlieb.com. Well, if you want to reach us here at Voices with show ideas or comments, visit our website. That's whyy.org/voices. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Gita Simons helped today's production. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Our associate producer is Elisa Walters. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.